From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Bill Moyers talks with us about his new PBS series, which brings together Bible scholars, teachers, novelists, and artists to discuss their interpretations of the book of Genesis, the Bible's story of creation. We'll also ask Moyers about the impact of the Bible on his life. He was ordained as a Baptist minister before becoming a journalist. Also today, a history of nuns. We talk with Joanne K. McNamara, who traces the changing roles of nuns in Catholicism over 2,000 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton has signed legislation that tightens airport security against terrorism.
We will install hundreds of state-of-the-art bomb detection scanners in our major airports to examine both checked and carry-on luggage. It will pay for a dramatic increase in FBI agents assigned to the Bureau's counterterrorism efforts. Now, background and FBI fingerprint checks will become routine for airport and airline employees with access to security areas.
As a result, Mr. Clinton said, Americans will not only feel safer, they will be safer. The measure also improves assistance to the families of victims of airline crashes. Three South Korean civilians have been found dead in an area where troops have been hunting suspected North Korean infiltrators. A military spokesman in Seoul says officials believe the three were killed by the North Koreans who came ashore from a grounded submarine last month. Charles Scanlon reports from Seoul.
Bodies of the three civilians were found near the city of Kangnung on South Korea's east coast, where a North Korean submarine came ashore in the middle of last month. A military spokesman said two men had been shot in the head, and an elderly woman appeared to have been bludgeoned to death. He said that empty cartridges from an M16 rifle were found nearby. The South Korean Defense Ministry says it suspects the three were killed by the remnants of a band of North Koreans who came ashore from the submarine. Thousands of South Korean troops have been continuing a search for the three infiltrators who are thought to be still on the run. 22 North Koreans from the submarine have been killed and one captured so far, but there have been no reports of contact with the remaining fugitives for the last week. For National Public Radio, this is Charles Scanlon in Seoul.
The vice presidential debate takes place tonight in St. Petersburg, Florida. Rick Stone of member station WUSF reports.
St. Petersburg had been designated a site for a presidential debate, but was relegated to running mate status when the campaigns trimmed the number of Clinton-Dole debates from 3 to 2. The city is consoling itself with the theory that since Al Gore and Republican Jack Kemp may very well be presidential candidates in 2000, St. Petersburg will be remembered as the site of their first encounter. The vice president has been rehearsing for tonight in the nearby resort of Longboat Key. Kemp has been training where Bob Dole made his preparations, at an oceanfront condominium near Miami. The Kemp-Gore debate will be nationally televised, but only low ratings are expected. For National Public Radio, I'm Rick Stone in St. Petersburg.
A campaign reform group is calling for an independent probe of both the Clinton and Dole presidential campaigns. Common Cause says both candidates are guilty of skirting federal elections laws. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down just over 26 points at 5,940 in active trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is up a fraction. This is NPR News. A Navy explosives team has located the black box from the Peruvian airliner that crashed in the Pacific Ocean last week. The main area of wreckage lies under 600 feet of water. Just before the plane went down, the pilot radioed that the computerized control panel of the Boeing 757 had gone blank. Catholics and Protestants are talking peace again in Northern Ireland, but the Irish Republican Army and its allies still are not in the picture. Instead, Ireland's Prime Minister strongly criticized the IRA today for the bombing attack at a British Army headquarters near Belfast. The Canadian Auto Workers Union says no progress is being made in talks with General Motors. As a result, union leaders say they'll expand their now week-long strike against the automaker. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Last week, more than 15,000 Canadian auto workers struck GM plants in Ontario and Quebec. Over the weekend, another 5,000 workers from other GM Canada plants joined them Tonight, the remainder of GM's Canadian workers will go out. Union bargainers want to force GM to stop outsourcing. That's the transfer of work to outside suppliers. So far, efforts to resolve that issue have been unsuccessful. The strike in Canada is having an impact on GM's operations in the U.S. Already, some 2,000 U.S.-based workers have been laid off. That's because GM facilities on both sides of the border are so closely integrated. Thousands more can be expected to be sent home in the coming week if there's no settlement. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A new study shows that the percentage of Americans who contribute to charities has fallen to 69%, the lowest level since such surveys began nearly a decade ago. The Gallup organization found that people are growing more distrustful of charities and the honesty with which they use their funds. On the plus side, among households that do contribute, the survey found the average donation was up about 10% last year. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Moro, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Moyers is often offered as proof that it's possible to produce popular TV programs that offer in-depth, reflective conversations. Before Moyers became a journalist, he studied at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and was ordained as a Baptist minister. Several of his programs over the years have reported on religion and its place in the lives of Americans. His new PBS series brings together Bible scholars, educators, novelists, and artists to discuss their interpretations of the book of Genesis. He chose Genesis because it's the source of the three great monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The series begins Wednesday, October 16th, and continues over the next 9 subsequent Sunday evenings. Moyers also has a companion book called Genesis, A Living Conversation. The series was inspired by a Bible seminar in New York at the Jewish Theological Seminary. I asked Moyers what excited him about that seminar.
Well, the first thing that excited me was a little item in the New York Times that described it as the best conversation in town. And, of course, covering the world of ideas for television, that's what I wanted to go and hear. So I called Rabbi Burton Vysotsky up and asked him if I could come. He said, sure, come on. I went. What I found was a collection of biblical scholars, both Jewish and Christian, a film critic, a screenwriter, a poet, an editor, an essayist, and a novelist, and they were really making the most of it.
You describe something that Rabbi Vysotsky said. You say he explains to newcomers that the communal study of the Bible can continue to provide us with a means for clarifying our ideas about the world around us and for linking them historically to a longstanding tradition. I like that way of putting it. Add to that for me. Tell me why you think it's important to talk about biblical interpretation on television.
Well, so much of the talk about religion over the last 20 years has been dominated by a politicized and polemical form of discussion. Sometimes I've thought that religion has just been reduced to another interest group like the National Rifle Association or the National Association of Manufacturers or the AARP, and sometimes that talk has also reduced Moses and Jesus to lobbyists with Gucci's own prowling the corridors of Congress advocating a tax break. Well, I know there's a lot of religious discussion going on in this country that has nothing to do with politics. In fact, religion has been giving God a bad name, and I just thought it would be a good idea if I could recreate on television what I heard there in Burt Vysotsky's seminar room.
In talking about the importance of Bible stories and of stories in general, you quote the Baal Shem Tov, a story that Elie Wiesel tells, that the Baal Shem Tov told. Would you tell that story?
Well, it's a story that's too long for me to tell, actually, Terry. It's the story of the rabbi who... The point of the story is that they keep telling these old stories because in telling them they tie themselves to the past. They keep the memory alive. The Jews have a wonderful notion that in remembrance is the secret of redemption, and that by listening and by recounting and retelling these stories of God's purpose in history and the response of the Jewish people, every generation is awakened to the necessity of carrying on that tradition and to the hope that comes from knowing that in the past the word has never died out, never disappeared, that it's always a force in the lives of people once they have unearthed it, brought it back, confronted it, and recounted it, and shared it. And that's what's so important about these stories that Rusovsky was saying, for example, that the story comes alive when you actually hear other people talk about it. Each of us is our own interpreter of the sacred text. And so I have something to learn from you because your own experience with that text is so different from mine. And when we talk about them together, communally, together, as Bert Rusovsky says, we're teaching each other and learning from each other. And that's certainly what I heard at his seminar, and that's certainly what I think happens in our series.
Do you remember a formative experience where you read the Bible and all of a sudden you saw something that you'd never seen before that gave that particular part of the Bible a brand new meaning, a meaning that no one had ever showed to you before, something you found for yourself that maybe even contradicted what you were brought up thinking it was supposed to mean?
Well, of course, the story of Jacob was a very familiar one to me when I was growing up and when I was in graduate school, but it was taken as the story and told as the story of the founding of Israel. Jacob, who after that dark ordeal of the night in which he wrestled with the stranger there by the river, came out the next day with a new name, Israel. And this was told as the historical, genealogical account of the origins of Israel. And that's how it was told to me. Much, much later, of course, after I had lost my own brother at the age of 39, and I was 32, and some matters were left unresolved between us, and after I'd had traumas in my own life, I realized just how much like Jacob all of us are, but me in particular, that I've wrestled in the night with my own demons, with my own fantasies, with my own failures, with my own images. There's a hearty discussion in the series about who exactly was Jacob wrestling with. Was he wrestling with God? Was he wrestling with an angel? Was he wrestling with his darker self? Was he wrestling with the image of his brother, who at that very moment, remember, Jacob had wronged his brother, Esau. And at that very moment, Jacob knew that Esau was on his way to greet him. And was he going to greet him with retribution and revenge over that insult of many years before? Or how? So maybe Jacob was having a premature wrestling match with his brother Esau. But whatever it was, when Jacob did get up the next day, he was renewed, personally transformed. His brother greeted him, embraced him, and said to him, I have enough. What is yours. Let's go in peace. Well, I begin, this was for me a realization that it's okay to have these wrestling matches with God. It's okay to have these wrestling matches with yourself, that much of what you're doing in your dreams and in your own inner confrontations is natural, and that one has to go through these experiences, but one is changed by them. I mean, Jacob left limping. He limped for the rest of his life. Some have said in our discussion groups that this is Israel as well, that Israel went through this transformation and has paid a price for the wrestling and for being chosen of God, has always limped through history, even with the great gifts of these people. So that was a very powerful experience when I read Jacob that way.
Did your brother's death send you back to the Bible to reread the Jacob story?
No. I came across the Jacob story much, much, much later than that, 10, 15 years after it.
Do things in your life ever send you to the Bible, or are these just kind of like parallel things that happen?
They're more parallel things. I never go to the Bible for proof text. What we used to say in seminary was the proof of the issue, that if you were having an argument with somebody, you just open the Bible and say, here, see, it says this, I told you so. I never use it that way. I was fortunate to grow up in a Baptist church that was emphasized thinking for yourself, what we call the priesthood of the believer, that you had to read the Bible and wrestle with its meanings and then bringing to bear the best teaching and the best scholarship, decide for yourself what it means. So I've never been to the Bible as a life raft, as a life jacket, as a pill to pop when I'm feeling down or when I'm uncertain. It's the fact that it's so woven into my whole life and that I read these stories as mirrors, in a way, of our own individual journeys. That's what gets me about, but the exciting part of going back and talking with these stories with so many people, 38 different people in the course of this series, is that these stories speak to us today because they are so starkly human. The people in Genesis rage at one another. They rage at God. They struggle with temptation. They're jealous. They're grief-stricken. They're patient. They're conniving. They're loving. They're hateful. And the dilemmas they face are ours: sibling rivalry, family violence, infertility and surrogate parenting, parents who play favorites. I mean, I read these stories now more as reflections of the human experience in the light of a believing person than I do reading them for instruction.
You preached for a few years, I think, before entering politics and entering
journalism.
I wouldn't
call it that.
You wouldn't call it a few years, or you wouldn't call it preaching?
I wouldn't call it preaching. Oh, I was pretty, I think one of the reasons I didn't pursue that is that it never came out quite right. I never felt comfortable doing it. I actually intended to teach, Terry. I wanted to go, I had signed up when I finished seminary to do my PhD at the university in American civilization, and I wanted to look at religion as a phenomenon in American life. That's what I intended to do. But in seminary, yes, I went out to small churches on Sundays and inflicted my amateurish wisdom on very patient and loving congregations of mostly farmers and their spouses.
Well, I'm wondering if anybody ever came up to you and asked you for advice about what the Bible had to say about their predicament.
Well, I had a very scary experience that was a turning point also in my life. I was pastoring at a student minister. I'd go out, my wife and I would go out on weekends, and I was in this small church. There were two sisters there, two spinster sisters. They must have been in their late 60s, and they lived with their brother on a farm not far from this church. And they were there this was only every other week I would go out. They were there. And one Sunday, they asked if they could see me after church. I must have been 20. Not quite 21. I was my second half of my sophomore year at the university. And they said to me that they admitted to me, they confessed to me in Protestant church, but this was a confession that they'd been having incestuous relations with their brother, and they needed help. They were deeply guilt-stricken. They were deeply disturbed by this, and they needed help. And what did I have to tell them? Well, I remember mumbling and fumbling something and saying, you know, let me think about it, and I'll come back to see you. I went immediately that afternoon the next afternoon when I got back back home, I went to a marvelous man who was a great and generous-souled minister, broad in his faith and learned in his wisdom, and talked to him. He said, Moyers, you've got no business trying to bring the Bible to bear on them. Thank God you didn't do that. I want you to go out to the university and see. And he gave me the name of a leading psychiatrist, psychologist who taught at the University School of Department of Psychology. I went out to see him, and this man said, well, I'll be glad to try to help them. It's a very serious issue. You tell them to call me, try to get them to come see me, bring them if they'll come with you. So the next time I went out, I went by to see them and talk to them, and I could tell that if the Bible couldn't help them, if I couldn't help them, then they didn't think psychology and psychiatry could help them. Now, this was back in the 50s when that generation of folk didn't have much use for the new psychological insights of the secular world, and they never followed through. And I realized at that moment that I wasn't equipped to help those people who hungered for some answer that I couldn't give them, for some help that I couldn't give them. So that was an occasion in which it wasn't easy to open the Bible and find something that would give them encouragement.
If you knew then what you know now, would you have pushed even harder for them to see a psychiatrist, or would you have like found something in the Bible that you think would would be a little bit helpful, hoping that that would at least set them off in the right direction?
Well,
the right direction. What do I mean here? I mean, obviously, they needed a lot of probably emotional help as well as just advice about how to behave.
I would have gotten them to a medical doctor who they would have trusted a doctor. I would have talked to the doctor about their mm-hmm. situation and mm-hmm. then had him take them by the hand and lead them in the next direction. And of course, there are so much, there are so many more avenues for help today than I knew of in back in the 1950s. So I would have tried a more cautious, careful, but loving relationship. I mean, I said to them that I didn't think they should judge themselves harshly until they did get some help that I couldn't provide them. I was trying to get them to move beyond the concept of sin to the concept of a deep problem that could be solved without so much denunciation that they were bringing, self-denunciation that they were inflicting on themselves because they thought the Bible, you know, condemned and this so harshly. I could have been a much more help to them. It's very, very dangerous to traffic at such an early age in the emotional needs of other people, and that was one of the reasons why I realized that I wasn't fitted for that. Actually, nowadays, you could find churches with counselors, with people whose experience is in psychology and religion, who could have been much more helpful to them than an untrained, wet behind the ears, aspiring theologian out in a country church with very little to go on.
My guest is Bill Moyers. He has a new PBS series and companion book called Genesis, A Living Conversation. The series begins October 16th. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bill Moyers, and he has a new TV series and companion book called Genesis, A Living Conversation, and it's a series of conversations interpreting the stories within Genesis. I'd like to step back for a moment to your previous TV series, the one you did in 1993 on healing in the mind, which was about the mind's effect on creating illness and also on curing illness. It was a wonderful series. I think it was about a year after that series went on the air that you had bypass surgery, heart bypass.
Yes.
I couldn't help but think, what a way to test what you had learned in the TV series. I really have wondered for a long time if that series affected at all how you handled your own medical care during that period.
It didn't in the beginning, but it did in the end. In the beginning, I was the last person that I would ever have expected of having a blocked artery, where it must have come from all that Texas barbecue and all that ice cream that I loved when I was growing up. But I did one January day in 1994, after I had done the series which aired in 1993 on healing in the mind, the emotions and health. I felt the pressure, and I wound up in the hospital, and ultimately I had a bypass surgery, and I got up too soon and went back to work too soon, accepted too many deadlines, and the symptoms all hit me again. This time I realized that I had to do something more than just let myself, to put myself in the hands of a traditional physician. And I went down to Beth Israel Hospital in New York and signed up for a three-month program sponsored by Dean Ornish, who's one of the leading young cardiologists in the country now. And this was conducted by Dr. Stephen Horowitz, who is the chief of cardiology at Beth Israel Hospital. And I will forget something that Dr. Horowitz said to me. He said, "Moyers, I've never known anyone who has a better intellectual grasp of this whole issue of emotions and health, mind-body. But I've had very few people who've had as little experience with it as you have." And of course, that's the issue for so many of us journalists, that we go after these issues professionally and we never appropriate them personally. Well, I went through this program 3 days a week, 4 hours a day, 1 hour of emphasis on guided exercise, the kind of exercise one should do that enables one to achieve certain milestones in the course of it, not just to do it for the doing of it, an hour on group sessions, group therapy. You're in that room with 20, 22 other people. You don't know any of them. They know you because you're on television, and so that is an immediate early impediment to discussion. I said, what am I doing in here? I've got my own experience to deal with. And yet, over the course of the actually 4 months, I learned so much from the housewife who was there, who was suffering from heart disease. I learned so much from the factory foreman from New Jersey who was talking about his experiences. I saw more of myself reflected in their questions and their confessions than I ever would have thought possible. And I came to really care about that group, and they cared about me, and we learned together. The third hour was devoted to meditation and yoga as a way of dealing with the stress in your body. Now, in my series, Healing in the Mind, I had a 90-minute program on the importance of meditation. We had filmed extensively at University of Massachusetts Medical Center, where Jon Kabat-Zinn uses meditation to help people suffering from chronic pain. I knew all about it intellectually. I knew all about it empirically. But experientially, existentially, I had not put myself into it. Well, in this hour, under a wonderful woman who truly has a way of bringing you to focus, to be mindful of the present moment, of getting you in your own inner world through contemplation and meditation, she did more for me in those 4 months than anyone ever has. And so I came to use meditation regularly. Even though I'm out now traveling the country, and every afternoon I've saved time for myself. I'll go back to the hotel room and I'll put on one of her tapes or the tapes I got from Herb Benson at the Deaconess Hospital in Boston, he's the one who introduced this whole idea of guided relaxation. And in 45 or 50 minutes there in the hotel in the afternoon, by meditation and contemplative yoga, I really renew myself and am able to spend the next 6 or 8 hours as if it were a new day. It's really different from looking at it as an observer and putting it to practice in your own life.
Bill Moyers, he'll be back with us in the second half of our show. His new PBS series begins Wednesday, October 16th. His companion book is called Genesis, A Living Conversation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Bill Moyers, and we talk with Joanne K. McNamara about her new book, Sisters in Arms, A History of Catholic Nuns. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bill Moyers. He has a new PBS series and a companion book, both called Genesis, A Living Conversation. When we left off, we were talking about his heart bypass surgery in 1994, a year after the broadcast of his PBS series, Healing and the Mind. What was it like for you when you were in the hospital recovering from the bypass, and here you were, Bill Moyers, Mr. Healing and the Mind, recovering in the hospital? You must have felt like quite the specimen.
I did, but the first thing that happened to me was really a transcendent experience. I'd been out for, I guess, in intensive care and recovery for about 48 to 60 hours. And when I the surgery was on Tuesday morning, I came to on Thursday at midnight back in my room, and the night nurse had fallen asleep over in the corner of the room. She'd gone to sleep with the television set still on, and Channel 13, the public television station in New York, at midnight that night was repeating what the previous Sunday had been a live performance of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Now, I love Beethoven and Bach and Brahms, and I'd listened to this particular symphony all of my adult life, but I had only listened to it. I had never experienced it. And when I woke up from this long life in this long passage in the netherworld, in slumber or wherever one is under the influence of anesthesia, that was on. And for the first time in my life, I experienced the music. The music was in me. I was the music. I don't know how else to say it except that there was a coupling there of that music and my consciousness in a way that was exuberant, that was exhilarating, that was in itself very healing. And with that, I was back in the real world, but I was back in the real world in a way I had never encountered it or experienced it before. So that put a different glow around my recovery, and I suddenly was able to understand all that I had learned intellectually in the producing and reporting of Healing in the Mind. And I had wonderful conversations with a host of doctors at Mount Sinai Hospital and nurses and therapists. Most of the therapists in particular, the occupational therapists, had seen the series Healing in the Mind. And, of course, it had kind of legitimated what they do. And here they had the living specimen. And we had marvelous conversations there. They thought I knew more about it than I did, because they thought that I had done the series because I had lived the life, walked the walk. I hadn't. I did the series because I was curious about this phenomenon.
I keep thinking about what a really fortunate experience it was to re-enter consciousness with Beethoven playing in your room.
One of those moments of gift, you know, that just happens to be a gift of life, a circumstance that turns into an illumination.
With the TV on, hey, it could have been Wheel of Fortune, you know?
And then I'd be a rich man today.
You know, when you have bypass, they virtually kill you and then bring you back to life.
Yeah, and they open up your chest.
Yeah, it's just a remarkable procedure. And from my experience watching people who've been through it, you're not yourself for a while. I mean, you're physically weak. Some people don't have their memory back for a few days or even longer than that. A lot of people have a period of depression early on in their recovery. Sometimes that depression lasts even longer. Did you go through a period of feeling not quite yourself and wondering if you'd ever be yourself again?
I went through a period that was a strange period. I'd never suffered depression, but I felt off balance. I felt that something had happened that I couldn't identify. Somebody had taken something out of me that I couldn't name, designate. That it was almost as if my foot was a few inches, one foot was a few inches shorter than it had been, or my gyroscope inside was out of tune, out of whack. I don't know what it was. It was one of those strange feelings like waking up from a dream and wondering if it had been a dream or
mm-hmm,
what.
Mm-hmm.
I made a foolish mistake. I did take out for 3 months. I had the surgery in May, but the 17th of September, May, June, July, August, 4 months later, I was filming 8 interviews a day at the Dodge Poetry Festival in New Jersey for an upcoming series on Language of Life, a series about poetry. And there I was, working from early in the morning until late in the evening, even as I was doing it, I knew it wasn't quite right. I didn't quite connect the way I had connected before when I was talking to people. I did not even know to what to ascribe it. But something I was off balance. It was actually a full year and more after the surgery, and after I went through this program at Beth Israel, the Dean Ornish program, that I really began to feel that both feet were back on the ground, that I was back in the world as I should be, and that I knew where I was and what I was doing.
I just find it so interesting that so much of your work has been related to religion. Religion is from a sociological, from a political, from a spiritual dimension, and more recently, your work, some of it has been about health, and those things just had to be so present with you during your period of recovery. You know, Bible stories. We think about that a lot.
No, I didn't. I really didn't. I read lots of poetry and had poetry read to me. I love nonfiction. I read Kathleen Norris's Dakota. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of literature in which people like me are actually exploring the deeper harbors of life, one can say. But no, I didn't read the Bible. Per se, I love the Psalms, and I did read the Psalms. But it's interesting, Terry. I do more traditional journalism than I do covering religious stories. I do investigative documentaries with Frontline. But you're right about
the point. You keep coming back to this.
Yeah, and I keep coming, and that gets the stories I do about healing in the mind, and with Joseph Campbell, the Power of Myth, and Genesis, and this year's series with Houston Smith on the Wisdom of Faith. They get so much more intense a response than anything else I do. I don't know why that is, except that, you know, for many millions of people, religion is a subjective reality. Faith matters. It affects their behavior. And even if they're unchurched people, even if they're people moving beyond the bounds of orthodoxy, they are people searching for some meaning in life, some deeper experience in life, even searching for some union with the transcendent reality. And I find this a phenomenon all across this country today, that people are trying to compose their own inner response to a chaotic world, and that they're turning to a variety of different sources. Some people find that consolation, that hope, and that information in beyond Orthodox religion. Some people move back to Orthodox religion. I think baby boomers are doing this to a considerable degree, turning back to these familiar texts to see what was unfamiliar when they first read them and can be appropriated today. There is something about this that, you know, there's a wonderful line in James Weldon Johnson's epic poem, Green Pastures, where Gabriel says, "Everything that's tied down is coming loose." And that pretty well sums up the modern world. I think it's probably always been true. One of my friends told me once that when Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden, Adam turned to Eve and said, "My dear, we live in an age of transition." I think that's true of every time, but this time seems to be much more, change seems to be much more intense, much more frequent, and happening every day. Something's different, and people are groping for some anchors, for some grounding, and they're having to compose their own.
Bill Moyers, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Bill Moyers has a new PBS series and companion book called Genesis, A Living Conversation. The series begins Wednesday, October 16th, and continues over the next 9 consecutive Sundays. Coming up, A History of Nuns. This is Fresh Air. Historian Joanne K. McNamara says there has never been a Christianity that did not rely on the prayers and services of dedicated women. In her new book, Sisters in Arms, she traces the changing role of nuns over two millennia. In writing the history of nuns, she discusses changing ideas relating to gender, celibacy, prayer, work, and the church hierarchy. McNamara is a professor of history at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. I asked her who the first nuns were in early Christianity.
I like to think of the Virgin Mary as the first nun, and certainly around Jesus there were a number of unmarried women. And this was a lifestyle that simply wasn't recognized in the ancient world. So that from the beginning you have communities of unmarried women, principally widows, but also virgins, who devoted themselves to the new religion.
You write that early on, becoming a nun, and later on too, actually, becoming a nun was actually a way out from a woman's limitations in life, the woman's condition. What were some of the conditions early on that women might have wanted to escape from?
Well, in the Roman Empire, it was the law that everybody should get married, everybody, and that everybody should have children. And women were not at their own disposal. They were obligated mostly to marry as their parents said. Now, on the other end of the social scale, frequently they simply haven't got parents, they haven't got protectors, and they're virtually invisible to society. They have no means of support except for prostitution and a few odd sorts of businesses here and there. So on the one hand, they get community by joining together, and on the other hand, they escape the single lifestyle that's imposed upon them.
Where does the vow of chastity enter into it? Or forgetting even the vow, just like chastity as a spiritual condition for nuns?
Well, it seems to begin at the beginning because you already hear about it in the Pauline letters. And indeed, some people would go further backward and draw it from Jesus' statement that there are those who make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven, which is a mystery. But certainly, I think by the time that Paul's writing, you have an order of widows, and they seem to be marked out as people who are formally recognized by the community, which implies a vow that they will retain their chastity and not marry again and observe certain conditions in return for the protection and support of the Christian community.
Now, you write that the most radical social concept that Christianity produced was the idea of religious men and women living together in chastity, recognizing their equal spiritual capacities. When did that happen, and what documentation is there of that lifestyle?
Again, that shows up in the Pauline letters. In the Corinthian community, a series of questions are asked of Paul about how does he feel about people renouncing sex altogether, and how does he feel about people who live together without marriage having renounced sex as chaste partners? Or that's what it seems to be, what they're asking. There's a debate about that. But certainly this is something that develops right from the very beginning, and it develops partially out of the question of how people who have vowed chastity are going to live. How will the virgins live? How will the widows live? Will they live with their own families, which some do, in their own house, if they can afford it, with each other? And one of the options is that they would live with men who have taken similar vows. But this was an option that frightened the official church.
You describe this approach to chastity as almost a third sex, something that transcended gender.
A third gender.
A third gender, yeah.
In what way do you think
that this approach enabled people to transcend gender, or that it was about transcending gender?
Well, it's about transcending sex. That is one of the reasons why a lot of us nowadays like to use the word gender is because we tend to think of sex as a biological distinction and gender as a social construct. So if your biology is your destiny and it determines your gender roles, if you give up the biological determinant, then you have, in certain ways, entered into the possibility of transcending the whole problem of sex roles. And I think of this as a third gender simply in the sense that it does transcend the divisive character of the male-female opposition and enable the individuals who embrace this lifestyle to come together and form a way of life based on their common humanity rather than their sexual differences.
You're talking about a certain approach to chastity as transcending sex and gender. But then at a certain point, nuns become the quote, the brides of Christ.
Yes.
When does that happen, the brides of Christ as the idea? And how does that change the meaning of becoming a nun?
The earliest use I can find for the term brides of Christ in reference to chaste celibate women is Tertullian, an African moralist who lived around the beginning of the 3rd century A.D. The bridal imagery itself is somewhat more spread and somewhat earlier, but it generally relates to the idea of Christ as the bridegroom of the church or of the Christian people. It comes from the Song of Songs and the imagery that's in that poetry. But Tertullian was apparently, we only have Tertullian's side of the story, let me say that right away. The only literature there is what he wrote. But he seems to have been involved in a debate with the virgins in his local church community, who, it would seem from his side of the conversation, have been telling him that they are not bound by the usual constraints of their sex, that they don't have to wear veils, that they don't have to be quiet in church, that they don't have to do the things that are generally said to belong to proper womanly decorum. And he works himself up into something of a fury. You know, do you think you're men then? What on earth do you think you're doing? And after talking to himself, I mean, he talks his way through this little dialogue. And after a while, he says, I got it. In effect, you are women. You are married women at that. You are the brides of Christ. So veil yourselves, virgins, and behave yourself as befits the wife of such a dignified master. And thereafter, at least one powerful use of the image of brides of Christ is not the kind of mystical union of the soul and the bridegroom, but it is really the institutional categorization of unmarried, chaste women as married women and therefore submitted to the constraints and the decorum that's imposed upon married women.
Yeah, you quote Tertullian as saying, be veiled, virgin, for you are wedded to Christ. To him you have surrendered your body. Act as becomes your husband's discipline.
Yes.
So it's a way of saying be submissive to, as women be submissive.
Yes, yes. Stop pretending that you're men. Stop pretending that you are not subject to the usual constraints on women.
My guest is historian Joanne McNamara, author of the new book Sisters in Arms, A History of Nuns. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with Joanne McNamara, author of the new book Sisters in Arms. It tells the story of Catholic nuns through two millennia. You were talking about the discomfort the church had about interaction between religious men and women. Was there fear of homosexuality as well? And is there any evidence in the literature that you read of lesbianism amongst nuns?
I have never found very much evidence of lesbianism again among nuns. And I don't think on the whole that the church itself as an institution was ever especially concerned. Rules for particular houses, and for a long time, convents are not grouped into orders. It's just each house has its own rules, or a group of houses will follow a rule. And they take certain precautions. They take precautions against the young nuns sharing a bed, for example. If beds are short, they say, put an old nun in between the young nuns. And even in the dormitory, when people are in separate beds, be sure that the young nuns don't kind of sleep together in a pack. Be sure there are old ones around. Be sure that the lights are on at night. Be sure that everybody is fully and properly clothed when they lie down to rest. So there's a certain amount of attention to that. There's also a much debated aspect of every monastic rule that forbids particular friendships, that two individuals in the community should not get too close together. And that, certainly in recent times, has been popularly interpreted as an attempt to prevent lesbian relationships. And in part, perhaps it was. But it also, I think, is a very serious attempt to prevent factionalism, to make sure that people do not drift into little cliques in a community, that two people don't sort of separate themselves and go off in a corner together, but rather that the whole purpose of monastic life is to forge a community.
What are the origins of the nun's habit, and what was the meaning of the garment when the idea was created?
Well, there never was a real kind of creation of nuns' habits. In the ancient world, and indeed up until fairly recent times, it was customary for married women to cover their heads. Indeed, even when I was a girl, going out without a hat was thought to be a bad thing to do. But the veil is basically the sign of a married woman. It's a sign of her modesty. The habits begin simply as the costumes that people wore. The wimples, for example, the cases that they wear around their heads, is a 12th century fashion. That's what all up-to-date ladies wore in the 12th century. So that most nuns' habits are a sort of stylized version of whatever the founding sisters wore at the time that the order was founded. And then they sometimes carry certain significance because the nuns themselves sort of endow their habits with a certain mystique. But there's not any really formal quality about the habits except that they should be modest. They should cover every inch of the body. They should try to negate any kind of sexuality.
What do you think are some of the stereotypes that we have now about nuns through history that you would like to change with your new history of Catholic nuns through 2,000 years?
Well, first and foremost, I would like people to notice nuns. It distresses me a great deal to read the piles and piles of feminist histories of women's involvement in reform movements, in charities, in the developed professions for women and all the rest, and never a mention of nuns. And nuns founded these professions. They developed all of these alternate ways of life. They carried the social services. You know, to talk about four people who founded settlement houses in the 19th century and forget about thousands of nuns who raised money, who went without food to pay for hospitals, for schools, for orphanages, for old age institutions, for every kind of social institution, and then have them just written out as though they simply don't count. Because what? Because they're nuns and nobody wants to look at that. So I guess that's my first purpose is to get people to recognize what these women did.
Joanne McNamara, her new book is called Sisters in Arms, Catholic Nuns Through Two Millennia. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Roberta Sharrock. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a spiritual from the CD Steal Away, featuring duets by pianist Hank Jones and bassist Charlie Hayden. This is My Lord, What a Mornin'. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as O.J. Simpson's civil trial continues, Simpson's criminal defense attorney, Johnny Cochran, talks about his role in winning a not guilty verdict for Simpson. Cochran has written a new book called Journey to Justice. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.